Kevin, you're saying that you're going to call Miami Approach right back. You're still on the frequency with that controller. They just dropped you. And you're going to clarify that you want to climb, presumably through at least the Class Charlie, and go over the top of the Class Bravo. If you're going to talk to them anyway, why not exercise option one and lead with clarification? Hey, don't drop me. I actually want a clearance through the Class Bravo on the published transition route. And then give them the opportunity to say, can't do that right now. Okay, then I want to go over the top.
I'm not going to push the issue of the Bravo clearance because there's a lot of reasons why they might not give you their Bravo clearance. But I would want to clarify that they understood that I was hoping for a Bravo clearance. So I might say, okay, understand I can't get the Red Road transition through the Bravo. I'm going to climb up above the Bravo. Can I get flight following going that way? And that might be just enough of a poke where they say, oh, the Red Road. Oh, okay. But probably that's not going to work in your favor. But at least it's just one more little thing to say, okay, this is just so we're on the same page. What I was asking for is a Red Road transition. But since I can, I'll climb above.
And that's probably part of the problem here is the pilot's missing those magic words that show that the research was done or you've got some kind of understanding. The pilot knows it's a VFR transition, can't find the chart that says it's the Red Road transition that I'm looking for. It's almost like a code word. Like, I did see the chart, but the pilot doesn't have the chart. Everybody here, kind of surprisingly, is choosing to go over the top. So how much of that is because you don't have the chart and you're not exactly sure where the transition is, and you don't know the name of it, versus an assumption that ATC doesn't want you playing in this airspace? Or is it something else? Catherine, you're smiling, so I'm going to go to you first. What's your reasoning for three, your primary reason not to just be like, hey, can't I just get that Class Bravo clearance, please?
So, okay, if I typically fly in Tennessee and you can bumble your way along and probably not hit sensitive airspace or airspace for which you need permission for a while. So, you know, you can fly longer and think a little clearer. If I were down here, honestly, I'd be kind of freaking out a little bit because this is some really complicated airspace. I live my life trying to not get on the evening news. So what I like about option three is it turns you in a direction initially where I can just kind of think, and I know I'm not going to hit any sensitive airspace. I mean, obviously, I've got some restrictions when I head east, but it's going to give me the most time to just kind of regroup.
Okay, that's the option that keeps you from bumbling into something, as you said. I might be freaking out here too, because at Cirrus speeds, you are in a really tight spot, and this allows you to move out to a place that gives you a little more breathing room, and that's the first step towards climbing over the top anyway. Wally.
Yes, I'm with Catherine. You can't park this Cirrus, you know? This guy would like to park it right now, figure out his chart thing. I mean, he had the idea, but now he's behind with that. Now ATC has said, you can't go forward unless you'd like to meet the FAA people down here at the office. So the quickest escape, I think, is to Kevin's suggestion, to get out of there, get some breathing room, and then you can begin to negotiate with ATC without blundering into somebody's Class Bravo.
Yeah. Brett.
Yeah, I want to come back to the iPad failure later. But first, we're flying a Cirrus here with a big MFD, so we have a good visual depiction of the airspace, of the surrounding terrain and water. And a big concern for me is being over the open water without the survival gear. And then also, I'm always about flying comfortably. So I know it's bumpy down low. I see clouds ahead. I got to stay VFR. So really three things I'm avoiding now, which is airspace, being over open water, and the cumulus clouds, because again, I'm VFR. IFR, I'm not too worried about a couple bumps at the end, but I need to stay clear of all those to be legal, safe, and get my family to the destination.
David.
I think this is an example where maybe some local knowledge could help you. You stopped at Sebastian. I would sort of look what's on the ramp. And, you know, you see a King Air or something like there, I'd say, hey, this is what I'm planning. You know, what's the kind of the locals in? And, you know, you get the code words, you get the, don't even ask for Class B at this time because you're not going to get it. Just plan on going straight overhead or something like that. Now, obviously, you got to do a sanity check on what you hear. But there's been a few times where I've gotten that three words to say that just like the sky's open and I could just kind of pop through because I've had that local in. I would like to reiterate what Brett said. Afternoon on a hot Florida day, I don't want to be at 1,500, 3,000 feet. It's going to be bumpy and nasty anyway. On top of the convection zone, atop the airspace, life's easy. So I'd have planned that right off the bat.
I got to go back to you, Kevin, on that. Wouldn't the controller rather have me on a specific transition route over the center of the airport rather than having me bumbling along anywhere over the top of the airspace, especially knowing that I'm trying to get over to something that's not lined up with the center of the airport? Because clearly that's the best place with Miami. We know they're landing to the east. Right over the center of the airport is going to be the best place for me to cross. Doesn't the controller want me on a transition?
I think generally that is a good spot to go, but there could be any number of reasons where you got something going on at that moment where it's just not a good thing. You could have a few go-arounds in a row for a reason. It could be wind shear, could be somebody taxied onto a runway they weren't supposed to. Any number of reasons, you got a bunch of airplanes out of position in a bad spot in the airspace, and you're trying to clean that up. Having another airplane in the airspace that you owe separation to, that can sometimes be a problem.
So I got to stick with you for a couple ATC questions. Number one, Class Bravo, clouds right at the published transition altitude. How much is that an issue for the controller who obviously can't see the clouds? Are they going to know and be like, yeah, there's no way I'm sending somebody through? Or are they going to wait for the VFR target to say, I can't fly on the heading you just gave me because it's going to put me through a cloud because it's just 3 miles and clear inside the Bravo. Is that going to be a factor? Is the controller just like, don't care?
I think that would really depend. But I think really the important point to make there is that ATC is not the cloud clearance police. So I don't know exactly where the clouds are relative to your airplane going through the sky. And if you're comfortable, then I'm comfortable.
Fair enough. Good answer. The other one is, can they legitimately drop me in this situation that close to the Class Bravo underneath the shelf of the Bravo and just outside the Charlie, but, you know, still like 11 miles from the primary airport? Shouldn't they have kept me on flight following anyway? Is that a legit move or did they kind of sweep me out the door?
I think ideally, yes, they should have kept you on VFR flight following, but we don't always exist in an ideal situation. And Miami specifically is one of the facilities that's in a really tough spot for staffing right now. And so they just don't exist in an ideal world. And no, I wouldn't be at all surprised about being told, like, sorry, I don't have the workload available for you. So it's workload permitting. And Squawk 1200, goodbye.
You know, your point, David, about local knowledge is a really good one here. As we were developing this scenario, we came across quite a bit about this particular set of transitions that I'll get into in a moment. But one of the things that they said was, if you are going through this airspace, don't even try between 8:30 and 12, and don't even try between 6:30 and 8:30. And interestingly, don't try after 10 p.m., they know when their pushes are and that, like, forget it. It's not going to happen. But outside of that, yeah, it probably can happen. So Steve, I haven't heard from you yet. You're another three here. Anything to add to all of the things that have been put forward so much?
I can just sort of put a narrow end at that funnel. I share the freak out. And, you know, there's a lot of blue and magenta and the radio chatter and everything for safety and for, you know, mental bandwidth, which also has to operate the aircraft. And, of course, I'm dealing with passengers, et cetera. I'm taking the sure thing. I got a capable aircraft that I know can get up there. I'm not worried at all about getting down. You know, I've got a clear path to do that. And I've already got the radio tuned in case something bad happens. And now I've got, you know, whatever other complications I might have. I'm taking the sure thing because in one fell swoop,
I have cleared the decks in terms of all the complication. And it's not as though once I'm going east or getting ready to climb that I can't renegotiate that. But I know for sure that that amount of bandwidth is now cleared out so that I can start making other plans. But in the meantime, aviate and navigate. And also, I'm scared.
I appreciate, again, like hearing, you know, experienced pilots talking about the intimidation factor. And I feel for this poor pilot who had a plan and then technology let them down and the anxiety that would happen. And ATC jumps in and they just jumped right on it. Yeah, that sounds good. Let's go to you, David. You had a comment in.
Yeah, earlier in the summer, I was on the terminal frequency for Vancouver. And there was a VFR going through, and there was this plaintive voice on the radio, my iPad just failed. I'm not sure where to go. And so there's this heavy sigh of the radio, steer 180. But, you know, the good news is the guy fessed up. And so I think it's also worth talking about, you know, how things can go wrong. The 7 to 10, 11 inches of diagonal magic there can fail more than just this way. There's other ways it can fail too. And so that raises the issue about if he had gone further in and the chart went away, it's really, really, really important you fess up immediately because you can create havoc, as I'm sure Kevin has seen, if you blunder around and not sure where you're going.
Yeah, let's just put a pin on that as well or tag something on the end of it. When we were researching this, the go-arounds out of Miami, if there was a jet go-around or they send a jet around, are climbed to 3,000. And for Fort Lauderdale, they're climbed to 2,000. So only 500 feet below these transition routes. And they're counting on you for that separation. And if they had to send a jet around, it's not like there's going to be a lot of warning on that. That's something that happens. So the details for these transitions really do matter. It is agreement of trust between the controller who's letting you through and the pilot. Brett.
Yeah, so let's go back to our iPad. This is our source of charts. And let's go back 20 years when we all learned to fly or whatever point in time that was. We started with paper charts. We had a sectional chart. We had a terminal area chart. On the back of the terminal area chart is the VFR flyway chart. And that's really what the pilot needed here. So he took for granted and maybe only knew his iPad, only knew his Cirrus, that the sectional chart magically turns into the terminal area chart, which is the higher detailed version of the sectional, which has the routing there. What they should have done is gone into ForeFlight to learn that better and realize they can also download the VFR flyway chart, which breaks out a lot of the complex details of the yellow. It's a lot simpler in colors, but it has those transition routes in detail. In ForeFlight, you can access that a couple ways. You can go in the document section, download it. That should be there for study. Also, you can go in and put that as a separate layer that you can overlay right on top of the sectional. Again, very simple. It has the flyway routes very clearly identified. And then that goes back to the key point of whenever using an iPad is to pre-flight that in advance. And my recommendation there with students or pilots with thousands of hours is to go ahead and turn off internet connection, Wi-Fi, cellular data connectivity, simulate what it's like to be in the airplane, and make sure those charts are accessible. So I know we've identified a bug in ForeFlight related to the TAC chart showing as you pinch in. That's a convenience feature. Really what we should have done here is had that flyway chart ready, studied in advance, just like an instrument pilot would for an instrument approach, be ready for it. We would eliminate a lot of this with that knowledge of calling the correct frequency and requesting the right transition.
And that absolutely would have bypassed this bug. For those who are curious, what's happening here is if you have the map touch action on, which is what allows you to switch between charts, there's a third chart, which is the Caribbean chart, that overlaps in exactly this space. And the logic in ForeFlight, as of this recording, can't deal with that. And so it ends up stuck oscillating between the Caribbean chart and the sectional chart. And you can't get to the TAC chart until you go far away from it or you turn off map touch action. But you're right, the fly chart is available either as a separate chart or as a layer, and that bypasses this whole thing. I also have to say that I think it's so quaint you said we all learned to fly 20 years ago, because it was a lot longer for a lot of us around the table. Catherine.
Yeah, so actually I learned something here. I didn't realize that. You know, I would have, honestly, I would have been this pilot zooming in thinking that I'm going to get the tack chart. And if that didn't happen, I'm not sure, honestly, I would have been quick enough to go get the layer to do that. So, I mean, this pilot is in some super tight quarters in terms of some interesting airspace that needs to be avoided. So I admit I probably wouldn't have felt like I had the time to go figure that out, or at least heading east might give me that time.
You know, and again, to Brett's point, if you hadn't packed beforehand and loaded that chart, unless you had amazing cell coverage or you had, you know, Starlink or something like that, you are out of luck because you are not getting that chart. It is, or layer, it's not loaded by default. And that really should be part of pre-flighting before going into complex airspace like this. So that's really well taken. Kevin.
There's so many different parts of flying where we think about the need for a plan B if our plan A doesn't work. And I don't think that's any different when we're talking about coming up on a Bravo airspace, where your plan includes getting a Bravo clearance. Well, that's highly dependent on the controller also thinking that's a good idea. So I think as you're approaching Bravo airspace, you ought to have a solid plan for, if they don't give me a Bravo clearance that I'm expecting or tell me to stay out, now what?
Steve.
When we all learn to fly, you could go to your flight school and grab a sectional for, you know, every adjacent area. Retailers like Sporties and otherwise will certainly send them out to you very rapidly. I love the convenience of the electronic. I'm a big fan, but understand that's also having a necessary effect on the lack of availability of paper charts. It is not for lack of virtue on our parts as pilots that we don't have the paper. I've had students come in and say, I'm going to Fort Wayne. How do I get a sectional for that? And it's like a two-day thing.
Paper is a technology. Paper can be a fantastic technology. But even just sometimes jotting down on a piece of blank paper, just the key things. Fort Lauderdale transition, 2,500. Red Road transition, 3,500. Follow the antennas, then over the direct, you know, just that text alone could have been enough here. Catherine.
Yeah, and you know, this is certainly something that about which I wouldn't have known. There are other ways that these things can fail. I was flying out of Boulder City earlier in the summer, and you know, there's a mountain range to the east of it, and I needed to kind of circle up before I ended up heading east. And that's some complicated airspace right around Las Vegas. And wouldn't you know, my iPad overheats. I was able to, you know, fairly quickly put up the sectional view on, you know, my PFD. But, you know, that took a minute. And honestly, I was kind of freaked out a little bit. So I know firsthand this, you know, the freaking out a little bit that I would be doing if I were this pilot in Florida.
Yeah. And it doesn't look, when you're zoomed out on the sectional, like this is horrible airspace. This is a class Bravo. And then you start zooming in and it is a sea of class deltas overlapping and such. And this is after our airspace redesign that took years to clean it up and make it better. I'd like to come back to that. But Wally, you had something you wanted to add.
Well, I just want to add that the pre-flight planning is so important. When I first started looking at this scenario, I failed to recognize that these routes were Class B excluded. I was totally surprised as I started to study this when the controller said, oops, stay clear of the Class B. And that's what happened to our scenario pilot. He also got surprised. And that's just pre-flight planning. I mean, it's pretty simple.
Yeah. David.
You know, one of my challenges is I don't fly a lot of IFR anymore, and most of it is flight tests. And I have to admit, I am behind on ForeFlight, because ForeFlight evolves quite continually and it has more and more features. And so it's kind of forced me to have a kind of recurrent training, internal recurrent training on the ForeFlight, because it's easy to forget what it can do and what's there. And so it's almost like now we got to start putting this in our recurrent training plan, not just flying the airplane. We really need once a month to sit down and refresh ourselves on how to make ForeFlight work, how to get the information we need.
Yeah, it is. I like to think of it as a piece of avionics. in fact, it's probably my most used piece of avionics for a lot of us, right? You have to think about, if this piece of avionics fails, what is my backup plan, as reliable as it is? Brett?
Yeah, I want to bring up the use of home flight simulators. It could be Microsoft Flight Sim, X-Plane. You can run Infinite Flight on your iPad. You could chair fly this ahead of time if you'd like, just to get familiar with it, get comfortable with the airspace. Obviously, you're not going to have the communication part, although you can. There are ATC services that you can bring into that. But go ahead and fly this flight, even if it's just on your iPad, moving it up and down through the airspace. You can even connect ForeFlight to your flight simulator, which, again, you mentioned an avionics piece. You're training with that avionics at home and go through that and say, okay, if I hit this point, I hit a stopping point, I'm going to turn here. See what that looks like visually. The graphics are so good in flight simulator applications now, too, using Google Earth and realistic satellite imagery. It'll help you get those visual pictures there ahead of time. And I think this pilot is a little bit anxious in this airspace, and I think that would have helped also. And no matter where you're going, like Catherine here mentioned, you're going to Las Vegas. That's a very busy airspace with a lot of terrain. I've flown in and out of there a lot, and that's can be intimidating. And so that can help you kind of get comfortable in advance.
Kevin?
One of the things we're talking about here is EFB currency, and this is probably one of the few things that we do with flying that we have a lot more flexibility on how we do this. This could be something where you get home from work at the end of the day, crack a beer, sit on the couch, and you're relaxing. You're like, where's an interesting spot to fly? I'm going to poke around in my EFB and just mess around with it and see what looks interesting to me and interact with it. And that'll help keep the rust from forming. And it's not so critical that you go to the airport and spend a bunch of time on it.
Yeah, I want to second what you're saying there, Kevin, because when we were developing this scenario, we knew the kind of thing we wanted, but we didn't want to set it in California, where, you know, we often set things that have complicated airspace. And I did exactly that. I chair flew. There might have been a beer involved while I was doing it, looking at different pieces of Class Bravo airspace, and came across Miami. I was like, huh, that could work. And found some YouTube videos, and then found a YouTube video about the redesign of this airspace and how it was put together. And that's how this scenario came into being. It literally started with that kind of chair flying and thinking, if I was flying through this, what could happen to me if I wasn't prepared? And we stumbled, or I personally stumbled across the bug in ForeFlight, and that sealed the deal. Like, there's the scenario. But if I had actually been going to this airport, I would have run across that chair flying it and had a much better understanding of the airspace and why that's there. Interestingly, and I think this matters to this point, the Red Road transition was an unofficial piece of local knowledge for years. And then enough people found out about it that Miami had to start refusing it because too many people were asking for it and they didn't know exactly what it was, and it was causing chaos. And the airspace had issues already with people cutting under the approaches to Fort Lauderdale and cutting under the approaches and departures from Miami. So when they redesigned the airspace to help deal with that, they made the Red Road transition and the Fort Lauderdale transition official transitions so that everybody was literally on the same page about where they should fly and how high they should fly. So kudos to, and these were controllers mostly at Miami who said, yeah, we've gotten a lot of requests. We want this back because it actually helps everybody. So it is kind of a team effort there. I want to talk a little bit about other options here, particularly going around and underneath the Bravo to the east and to the west in this case. There are a lot of reasons you might do that. One, maybe you really do want an opportunity to see what's going on down low, or maybe that broken layer above you, if it's a fully broken layer and you're not instrument rated, you know, this pilot had the option of climbing above and this pilot had the option of going IFR, which might have made all of this go away. But that's not going to be the case for a lot of people. I mean, uncomfortable, or they're going to have to go under. East versus west, if that's what you were faced with here, which would people do? Would they, in this specific situation, which would you do? Kevin?
If I was appropriately prepared for flying over water, which if I'm doing this trip with my family, I'm going to be.
Okay. So let's assume that you've got the gear on board.
So assuming I have the gear on board to fly over water, I don't have any problem going around the east side of the Bravo. But like I said, I'm probably not going to hug the shoreline and be mixing it up with the banner tows and everything else and the helicopters and all of that is right there. I'll go a couple of miles out and be over the water and be perfectly comfortable.
Why not the, when you say the east side, why not the west side? Other than, is there any reason other than the alligators? And I share your fear of swamps and alligators as a fellow New Englander, but is there anything else about going around that side? Because there's, you know, going to be no banner tow traffic over there, probably fewer people sightseeing. Yeah, there's flight training that happens around here, but there's a lot more space on that side. So why not that way?
Pretty much just the wildlife is enough for me.
You've seen the Florida wildlife.
I've been there. It's really neat to see, but I don't want to have an unplanned visit to it.
Yeah, fair enough. I saw some locusts once going across Alligator Alley that I mistook for sparrows initially. It was frightening. So yeah, I get it. Steve?
I have in fact made this decision and come down on either side of it, but you have to substitute Chicago for Miami. And the trip is Oshkosh and going around the horn to Detroit. If I'm in an 80-year-old warbird with the glide ratio of large, dense object, you know, and insert here, I'm going around the west side. Again, it's not swamp, but depending on your view of the Chicago suburbs, maybe it is. The wildlife is variable in that respect. Sorry, Chicago. But if
we
I'm
just
in...
just lost seven subscribers, yes, right there.
If I'm in a motor glider, I'm totally going under the Bravo and coming around on the lakeshore. And in either case, I'm talking to ATC, so I've got somebody to talk to, and I know where to initially send Civil Air Patrol.
Wally.
Well, I want to add one more reason for Kevin not to go around the west side, and that's we forgot the boa constrictors now as well.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to the west side. And they're going to chase you down low. They're going to get you below the departing or arriving airplanes from the west. But that's the way I would do it. I wouldn't have even tried this thing, I don't think. Just because of the congestion and the complication, I'd just go around the west side and do it on flight following, or more preferably IFR, and deal with that descent problem at the end very easily.
Right. If you're going around the west side, you're definitely low enough that you don't have the descent problem as well going there. Brett.
Yeah, I want to emphasize something Kevin mentioned earlier. If you go on the west side, you're probably going to be hugging the base of the Class B airspace, and you have the winds out of the east and the arrivals coming in, landing to the east. There's a real wake turbulence potential there. So you're now balancing your distance above the alligators and your distance below the heavy wake, and that's not a fun place to be. So if you do decide to go west, and Kevin could probably expand more on this, give yourself more than a couple hundred foot buffer below the shelf of the Class B to give yourself that protection. Have your traffic alerts on ForeFlight. Be aware because you could be within separation issues or cause separation issues for the arrival traffic.
Yeah, and that was a lot of the redesign was this, the TCAS alerts were going nuts along these lines. David.
I'm not so worried about going west about being eaten because my drowned body will not feel anything.
This just gets darker and darker.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can drown in 2 feet of water, and there is a lot of water in the swamp. So I don't think it's actually less of an issue, you know, being in the water, depending on which side you go. You could potentially be in an area where drowning is a serious possibility. So it's not like land water. It's water or sort of water, bit of water. The other issue is comfort. If you get a few miles offshore over the water, it's going to be a lot smoother than going over the swamp. And so it's going to be a nicer ride for your passengers, and it's going to be a lot more scenic. But that's presupposing you have adequate gear, which I think, as Kevin pointed out, if you're flying anywhere on this area and you don't have that, then you're really being foolish, in my view.
Yeah, and as someone who, you know, would fly coastal quite a lot, you know, different parts of this country, that was always a strategy. Right? You'd fly over the land, you know, in the morning, and you'd fly over the water in the afternoon, but just to be on the you know, more stable side of the airflow. And so just a little bit offshore in the afternoon can make all the difference in the world. That may be where these clouds are coming from, too. It's just heat rising off the land, drawing water off the water, drawing, you know, moisture off the water, and 3,500 feet, that's where we're getting condensation. Kevin, you had something you wanted to say.
The wake turbulence comment that we had earlier, just speaking about Class Bravo in general, there's a lot of times where, maybe even most of the time, where you have these large and heavy jets are being vectored around at the floor of the Class Bravo. And so whatever distance you are below the Class Bravo could be the distance that you have between you and the heavy that's above. And so a few hundred feet is just not a comfortable spot for me to be below whatever big heavy jet is climbing or descending above me.
Catherine.
Yeah, if you diverted to the west, though, I know we're talking about flying under the shelves, and the shelves I'm seeing like a 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. It doesn't add much to the trip to go out just a little bit more to the west and get some more altitude. And that way, if you had some sort of an anomaly, you'd probably be able to get to an airport.
We're talking about going to Tampa? There's a lot of swamp out there.
Yeah. And the other thing we're not seeing here, but you might see on ADS-B, there is a ton of flight training traffic down here too.
Yeah.
And most of that is located out to the west as well. So you might get around over there and suddenly it's just sort of anarchy of people doing air work and you're trying to find your way through in your Cirrus. This scenario, to me, it all comes down to preparation. The plan itself wasn't really flawed in any way, but the key elements of the plan, its backbone, were under-researched, and the backups for the plan were lacking. The takeaway, to me, is really to chair fly at the very least new locations or use a sim, especially when you've got unsuspecting passengers on board. That might be another stress and a distraction. And then when you do, look for where the problems will be. And maybe even if you don't see any, have that plan B at the ready, particularly with the Class B airspace.